Hi, and welcome to another episode of Rule of Carnage. This is where myself, Glenn Ford, a games designer and developer, talks to this guy, Mike Hutchinson, also a games designer and developer, about designing better miniatures games. So today, we recently had a chat about AI and solo mode gaming. And a thing that occurred to me in relation to like solo mode gaming, narrative gaming, is that you can create a solo mode that has a true sort of narrative imperative to it, which is sort of big and possibly misused words there. But my point is that if you've got a solo game, you can have a hero, and that hero can have what is often referred to as like plot armor. You know, you in a solo game, you can have Aragorn and he can walk into a room full of goblins and you can make it so the goblins just can't kill him in the first room. And that's all there is to it. And so you can build up a lovely story of heroes marching through swathes of enemies and coming to the end and having something quite climactic.
And you sort of mean in this regard that in a solo miniatures game, you as the game designer can be more like directly in control of the story that the player experiences or that unfolds in front of them.
Yeah, no one cares how much of a bad time the AI is having. You know, it doesn't matter that it doesn't have a chance at a given moment. And so if you say that a particular hero is sort of super heroic and sort of high fantasy, you can just have it be unfair for the goblins against him. Mm-hmm. And you can't do that in a player versus player game. In a player versus player game, if you say, okay, this guy is like super powerful, and you also say that this guy is super powerful, then you've got to have, A, you've got to have like one of them go down. And B, you've got to have a situation where sometimes Aragorn walks up to the first goblin goes, yip, and Aragorn goes, ah, and dies like, you know, 32 seconds into Lord of the Rings. You know, Aragorn maybe jumps off a small ledge, shatters his knees, and is just done for the rest of the scenario. And the question is, I guess, how do you get players to give each other a narrative space? You know, how do you encourage them to game to the narrative imperative rather than, as I say, just pinning somebody up against a wall and smashing them with a hammer for 5 minutes because it's dull as anything, but it's really effective. And it's one of these places where it's one of the places I'm most constantly jealous of computer games in, because it's like there's two places I really sort of like, yeah, why can't we do this? It's like, In a game like Resident Evil, there's these cinematic moments when you walk into a particular room, and because you walked into that room at a particular time from a particular angle, it triggers a set of events, and you get a sort of series of cinematic things that happen, and you get these set pieces, which you can't do in our sort of tabletop games. And the other place is like, there's the game Devil May Cry. Now, there are other games that do this, where if you do something new, if you kill somebody in a new way or a particularly stylish way, you get rated. And so there's a disadvantage to just going round and hitting everyone with the hammer five times in the head, you know, over and over. You have to do cool stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, this is the sort of thing where votes in Gaslands are leaning towards, and some of the things we've tried to pull out in some of our designs. And yeah, so that's kind of the conversation I wanted to have here today.
Right, yeah. So I guess a couple of like framing thoughts from me. So think, like, staying with computer games for a while, like one thing that's certainly true in single player computer games is that it's really clear who the hero is. Like, there is one player and that player is controlling the hero. And so one critical question as we're chewing on this is, like, in a game with two players head to head, like, who gets to be the hero and at what point do they get to be the hero? And then video games like, you know, World of Warcraft, like in World of Warcraft you're never the hero except through sort of the game bending reality, so that when you go into a dungeon to do a sort of quest line, like, you are temporarily the hero in that sort of self-contained bubble universe, but you can see other people running into the dungeon who are heroes in their own story, but on a global scale you aren't. And then I guess the second sort of framing thing is, this reminds me of a conversation I was listening to on a role-playing game podcast, where they were asking the question, how do you, they were specifically, the example they were using was Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Like, imagine you're playing a campaign of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Is one of the players Buffy? And if so, how does anybody else do anything in the campaign, given that there's one obvious hero? And so how in World of Warcraft do you give players an experience that is fun and let them be in the narrative? Or how, if you're playing a role-playing game where nobody's Buffy, or one player's Buffy, like what happens there? And so I think in a head-to-head miniatures game, like how do, like you've got a couple of potential routes into this. One is the sort of narrative scenario campaign path, and the other is the sort of pickup game path. And I think obviously the narrative one, we're going to have much more freedom and flexibility, and I think the hardest one is like the default game experience of getting to the table, and one of you's the men of the West and one of you's the goblins. Like, how do you encourage stories to come out of that?
Yeah. And I think, you do often get significant problems because of that. Because there is always that question of, like, okay, you know, you're playing Lord of the Rings. There is a certain mindset to an individual who then chooses to play the goblins, where it's like, I'm not only am I not the hero, I'm not Sauron, I'm not the Balrog, I'm literally choosing to play the cannon fodder. And yet, you know, I'm going to create a situation where Lord of the Rings ends like 20 minutes into the first movie and nobody enjoyed it. And that's what I'm sort of out to do to a degree.
And so are you in pitching this topic, are you thinking like, how can I be the author of this tale and give players enough agency to have a good game, but still sort of guarantee a narrative arc as they play? Or is this, because it feels like we in the past we talked about the emergence of story through play, and I think that
where I'm going with this is more questions about how do you balance those sorts of narrative imperatives. How do you protect plot lines that you want to happen? What are the differences between solo games that can have these plot lines very protected, but then how do you keep them fresh? Because once you've gone, okay, this is the plot line for this story, and then you go down that plot line, you're like, well, what's the next plot line? Well, I've only got so many pages in the book. Eventually I've got to do something emergent, and how do I continue to protect it whilst keep it challenging? Those sorts of questions. So relating back to, like I say, for as an example for the sort of the balancing system, how to ensure that Aragorn doesn't get shanked in the first 5 minutes in the game, Games Workshop's Lord of the Rings has a neat little system of the will and fate and might points for heroes, where they have these sort of, they have sort of rules embedded plot armor, as it were, that there are as I say, when we watch movies, it's like when you're watching Lord of the Rings and there's the bit where, oh, has Frodo just been stabbed and is Frodo dead in the no, we all know he's not dead. Nobody is thinking, wow, I thought this was a trilogy and yet the lead character's just gotten, you know, carked in the first movie. We all know he's not dead, he's got plot armor on. You know, and in the Games Workshop system, they've given certain heroes certain levels of plot armor. You literally cannot kill Aragorn on the first hit. He has the special resource that says, no, I'm surviving until the second half of the battle. No matter what happens, I will be there at the climax. But it's done in a balanced way. It's not done in a sort of, you know what, Aragorn can just charge into the middle of the enemy army going, I'm indestructible. It's just a matter of how many of you I get through before, you know, I run out of time. It's a thing where they've gone, okay, you can't do him in the first sort of few turns, but it's a resource. It's something you pay out. It will run out eventually. How you use those different resources, the characters that have renewing resources versus the characters that don't. I always thought one of the most fascinating things they did to that system is the fact that they made Boromir incredibly sort of powerful in close combat and unbelievably vulnerable to arrows by the use of this system. And it's really, I think that one's particularly fascinating. And it allows you to sort of, allow them to build narratives into player versus player games. The other guy didn't need to be wanting, you know, Boromir to die to a hail of arrows. He didn't need to be wanting Aragorn to make it through and stand next to the dead Boromir and, you know, vow to follow his line on. But that would happen because of the way the rules were built out. And it's sort of some things you can do and some places you can create that so that players can go at each other as hard as they possibly can and yet end up with these sort of these narrative stories that you can.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's almost like you're creating valves in specific places in your rules. So however much pressure the players apply, the place that's the weakest that's going to let that game experience through is the bit that you've specifically engineered to be the most likely thing to fall out.
Yeah, and you know,
which I think really that really ties back to that idea of like emergent gameplay and making sure that your rule system is focusing on trying to achieve the cinematic moments that you want it to achieve. And this is, I think, just a kind of different way of attacking that same thing, which is, well, if your game is about cars flipping or, you know, spaceships crashing into each other, then make sure that those are things that both exist in the rule and are possible to happen, but are also rewarded in some way.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's about. I would say it's about rewarding and protecting these moments, sort of in equal terms. There's moments that you want to occur repeatedly. These cinematic narrative beats where, you know, it is important that this individual does X, and I need to figure out a system, a mechanic, to give you a sweetie whenever that person does that, so that you will, as a competitive player, seek out that behavior. And then I have to figure out the things that I really don't want to happen, and I've got to build in mechanical protections around making sure those things don't happen. And I think in a player versus player game, in order to achieve an intelligent narrative, those are the bits that I think you have to recognize as your sort of narrative imperatives, and those are the things you want to protect. Because we can't sit down and go, okay, this happens, then that happens, and then you go into this room, and then this very climactic thing occurs, and that's lovely, and then you'll go into this room, because I can't rail you or channel you through things. I've put you in a playground, and I'm letting you go for it. I've got to figure out where I can place these force shields and around some things and shiny goodnesses around other things to encourage player psychology and protect player accidents and sort of screw ups, basically.
That seems like a good place to take a quick break.
And it's interesting because, like, if you're doing a narrative campaign and you've got objectives that are telling you where the story is supposed to go, like, you know, one of you is going to blow up the dock building and the other person has to escape with the cargo before the dock building gets blown up, like, that's another way of applying pressure or rewarding certain player activities, because both players can ignore those and just, you know, beat the snot out of each other if they want to, but you're not rewarding them with the satisfaction of engaging with the narrative and seeing their characters kind of tell out the story. And so it's asking the players, if you want to win, engage with the story, because I've told you that the win conditions and the story are are highly correlated.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously there are going to be points where players either consciously sort of ignore the objectives because they do just want to beat the snot out of each other and they think that that's immensely funny. And then, you know, you're enjoying yourself, crack on with that. And there are other places where players don't spot the objectives and the narrative drives. And I do think that's quite an important thing to address. The number of times I've played games with objectives as opposed to turn up and kill each other and absolutely walked the game because the other player basically doesn't read the objectives or doesn't comprehend that killing me is meaningless. And there is a certain sort of player whose first thing they do when they turn up to any given game is, all right, what are the victory conditions? I kind of don't care about anything else. Everything else is going to be, you know, much for muchness. Things will shoot in a certain way. Things will move in a certain way. What are the victory conditions? That's all I kind of care about. And then there are those players who are going to turn up and go, well, what I'm doing is I'm shoving things around a table.
In that distinction, I think there's two sort of narrative imperatives, and maybe we can separate them to make it more useful. Like one is, I think, like, does Aragorn get killed by a goblin in the opening 2 minutes of the movie? That in and of itself is like a dramatic emulation problem. It's like when that happens, you go, oh, well, this game is rubbish because this game isn't doing what I would expect it to do, which is protect Aragorn from a random, you know, sharpened stick goblin. And like, regardless of whether or not your game then goes on to successfully tell the Lord of the Rings story is irrelevant to this central point, which is like, it's a bit like it's essentially realism. It's a drift on realism. It's like realism and emulation, successful emulation, are kind of the same beast, even though people tend to pull them apart and make them separate. Like if a little handgun can easily pass through six concrete walls and into the side of a tank and kill a German tank driver, we would say that was unrealistic and it's pulling us out of the fiction that we're trying to create, and it's not representative of history and blah blah blah. But ultimately it's the same moment of disconnect where it's like, well, dramatically I was expecting my movie to have a kung fu fighter that could take a few hits before he got like exploded into blood, but like this guy's just like suffered a realistic crippling like ankle injury the first time he tried to do something cool. This isn't a kung fu game in the same way that realism. And I think like ensuring that the fiction that you're trying to create, whether that's realistic simulation of physics or like correct feeling dramatic emulation, like that's one critical thing. And then the second thing is, if I'm going to try and help you tell the story of Lord of the Rings, then of course I need to make sure that that narrative arc has enough armor on its critical players so that I can let you play that out. And I think in that regard, like something like a campaign system injury role from Necromunda or Frostgrave or, you know, or a million systems that have that. Like, that's an example of like the preservation of the overall arc can be maintained by the fact that, do you know what, your leader never dies, or it's very, very unlikely that they die because you have to get a 99 and a D100. But they might start getting a limp and have one eye, and they'll be really cool by the end of the campaign. You know, your general might have, you know, all kinds of weird equipment and weird injuries and stuff, but they've been protected in order for you to tell that longer story. And I think that telling that longer story like that, for me, like, we know what the systems for that are. It's either a narrative campaign where I tell you what's going on, or it's an emergent sort of progression system campaign where you end up telling the story, and either it's a brutal system where you expect your leader to die and be replaced, or it's a slightly gentler system where like the person who started at the front of your gang is going to, you know, like in Frostgrave, the wizard is going to, you know, make it to the end, except maybe they'll die and the apprentice will take over, but that's really just the wizard again.
Yeah, I think that moment where you're saying, you know, oh, well, you've got the version where you have the post-game injury roll and there's a like one result on a D100 that can actually kill the guy. I think that result is a lot of the nub of where some of my feelings about this is why have you got one result on the D100 table that has it? And it's like, either we're playing some sort of really gritty dark thing and like half the results on the table cripple you and a quarter of them flat out kill you. And it's like, all right, great, my guys aren't making it through. It's not that kind of, I'm playing like a Darkest Dungeon, you know, a Morkborg thing where the point is everyone just gets jammed through this mincing machine and it's the survivors that flop out the end of it that, that have got a certain story. Or there's no dead result on my leader's injury table. And the thing is, all right, it's a high fantasy thing. Aragorn is making it to the end of the campaign. Having like a one out of a D100 that kills you on those injury table dry absolutely makes me furious, because what do you want there? What do you want me to roll it, hit the one and go, but that wasn't meant to happen. That clearly wasn't meant to happen.
Right, right. And so for a certain class of player, the existence of that explosive tile means that the D100 roll is just N times more exciting. It's a bit like a treasure roll where like it could be a pile of crab shells or it could be like the hammer of godly destruction. And like the fact that there's a deadly result there, I think for some players, definitely not you, will make that dice roll more interesting for them.
I think it's like have
even though when you hit it, it's garbage, and you're like, let's just re-roll that because that's garbage. Yeah.
This is very true. This is very true. It's that thing that's sitting there going, oh, this is very exciting. Yeah. Oh, I got it. Well, I'm not gonna accept that.
It might be that it's fool's gold, and like you can see through that, and so you reject that fool's gold. But for many people, you know, potentially for myself as well, it's like, well, ooh, that's there. So
it's like sometimes you've got like a D100 table and you've got rerolls available. And it's like, well, why? Why is that one? Because obviously I'm getting that one and then I'm obviously rerolling it. And what happens when I reroll and get the one again? And like, everybody knows I'm not meant to have got it. Everybody knows I'm not meant to have got it after the first game of the campaign and ruined the entire campaign for me now, because I've got like little Jimmy is now my leader and he's just, look out for little Jimmy. And everyone's like, well, now you're whipping boy for the rest of the campaign. Mm. And it's like I say, I'm fine with the result that kills me, but if you don't mean for it to happen, just don't put it in there. I have this opinion that it's possibly something to do with whether you're the sort of person who finds the idea of live TV more interesting and exciting than recorded TV. I don't care that the show is live. It doesn't make me more excited and thrilled to know that
the peril, Glenn.
It's completely false peril. If I'm not going to see somebody like die on my TV. That isn't actually there as an option, you know. And you know what? I'm not excited by peril in that way. You know, if I want to watch TV, I want something that's been sort of set out to be dramatically interesting and narratively worthwhile. And the fact that somebody might fall over at some point doesn't then excuse to me the fact that a lot of the time everyone just sits around doing not very interesting things, but that's acceptable because it's live.
Well, and there's very much like there's a how controlled, how guaranteed is the experience. Mm. And I think that's like, you know, it's not a binary, because a narrative campaign with a bunch of scenarios that are supposed to like build the story up, and by the time you get this like incredible cataclysmic finale, like you can't guarantee that the players are going to understand and enjoy each game in the way that you intended. They might lay the table out wrong, or they might have a bunch of bad dice rolls, or they might be having a bad day. And so, like, you know, on a single player video game, like you've got control of the camera and the environment and everything is, you know, and people can go back and play things really easily. And they're very clearly the hero of their own story. And I think even in a narrative campaign, like you've got so many possible places that your intent can go wrong in its communication to the players, that in some respects, imagining that you are able to communicate a coherent narrative is itself folly, and you'll probably end up doing things that weaken the gaming experience as you're trying to press what is essentially a incompatible narrative structure onto a media that doesn't serve that very well. Like, if we're dealing particularly with head-to-head games, then like there are tons of things that this medium does extremely well, but a controlled you are the hero narrative is just not one of them. And so I guess part of the question here might be like, why are you trying to, you know, make a book? Why are you trying to make a game be something it can't achieve?
No, I agree. But the point is that there is a level of narrative imperative that we do want in our games. We do want that Gaslands is a game about cars smashing each other into each other and flipping and blowing up. We do want a certain driver to be a ramming-based driver and a certain driver to be a shooting-based driver. We do want those stories to naturally occur on the tabletop. We want to put a level of control on that. You know, we don't and we can't have a situation where, you know, you are the hero and you, like, you know, I'm one of the rare people who played through the Warhammer End Time stories. You know, two things. One, I don't think anybody who's played through them twice, you know, which is a very significant issue with, like, hard narrative campaigns, is that they have very little repeat value to them. Two, repeatedly through that campaign, there are points where you basically had to sit down prior to the game and sort of have a conversation of, look, this is what is meant to happen. We will both get the most available fun from this if this happens. I'm not saying let's meet in the middle and have this occur, but let's both bear in mind that we'll have a more enjoyable day if these two guys happen to meet up at some point.
Mm.
You know, okay, we'll both want to shank the other guy a little bit before he gets there, so we'll have an enjoyable thing where we win, but we both want this to happen. The whole thing is built for this to happen. And it creates an inherently unsatisfying experience, and that is true. But at the same time, there is this thing where, okay, if I just put a bunch of things onto the tabletop and there are no heroes and leaders and there are no dramatic moments, you know, that's also not a satisfying gaming experience. And one of the
questions, funny, because that first one that you described is a bit like it's almost non-competitive. It's a collaborative storytelling with miniatures. It's like, well, we've been given two armies and two sides, and normally what you do with this is you play a head-to-head competitive experience where you both try and win, and sort of by reading the scenario and the fiction that goes along with it and wanting to recreate the fiction using the scenario, are you in fact agreeing to this being a shared petri dish, and we are going to we're going to engineer an experience that is essentially like a miniature sort of cinematic retelling of this, and it doesn't matter which army wins, because we know which one's going to win because the story already told us which one wins. And then the question is there a sufficient number of your players who are going to enjoy that different way of playing? It's perfectly reasonable, it's just not the default.
I mean, there is the option there to have like asymmetrical scenarios where it's like, well, this side is going to lose because it's clearly going to lose, it's outnumbered 50-1. But
you could even say that with the victory conditions, like the victory conditions could be like,
yeah,
the goblins can't achieve any victory points, and for each goblin that, you know, the heroes kill, they get a victory point, so it's going to be 100-0 every time.
Yeah, there are lots of ways you can do this and say, you know, okay, this side is going to win, but there's a bigger story.
Right.
So, or, you know, this side is going to be slaughtered on the tabletop, but what are we playing to find out? If we're playing a historical game where a certain side got wiped out but killed 50 people in reality, then, you know, you win if you kill 100 people and you lose if you kill 2 people.
Right, and a classic thing in when I'm thinking about narrative scenario campaigns is like, well, how can one game affect the next? And so, like, the plot armor of, you know, the dwarfs and Gandalf are running through Goblin Town and they are going to escape, but then maybe the question is, how many goblins do they kill? And if they kill a certain threshold, then in the subsequent game, there's fewer goblins to deal with, or, you know, or more goblins, or the Goblin King is there or not there. And so we know that these guys are going to escape and they're essentially going to win by escaping. But then there's a different question on the table of like, how will the narrative further down be affected by the success, the decisions that you made and the successes that you did or didn't have on the table?
But I think for a non-narrative game scenario, for a pickup game scenario, for a sort of standard system built for it, I think the point I would like to sort of reach to here is to say, you know, it's worth considering what the narrative of your system is going to be. And you're going to have rules that drive people to certain places, and you're going to have rules that say, okay, well, this is a battle because you're lined up and you've got guns and whoever kills the most things win. But also consider a secondary layer of, you know, what are going to be climactic moments? What do you need to do to protect those climactic moments, help them out, assist the players in having them occur more often than not? It doesn't have to be that they occur every single game, and it doesn't have to be that, you know, players can't get around that armor and have them, you know, and short circuit the system, but have it so that on the average game, when things averagely play out, you have a nice narrative arc, and you have things that, okay, they're not the full-on imperative that they would be in a movie, but they are narratively supported by the protections and the encouragements that you give to those moments within a certain design. And I think, as I say, I think there are various ways you can do it. You can go, as I say, I think there's the Gaslands route, where you give people sweeties for certain behaviors. There's the Lord of the Rings route, where you give certain moments extra layers of plot armor, but in interesting sort of and worthwhile ways. I just think take a minute to identify the thing you would like to have happen more often than not at the end of a game, and make some considerations of how you can bolster those moments and help them out and give them extra support and create a sort of narrative flow to non-narrative games.
Nice. And I suppose, given a summing up, that presumably means that we've reached the end of this conversation, Glenn.
I think that's an acceptable place to end this conversation. Thank you for watching, if indeed you still are. If you are, please do like and subscribe. It helps us to do what we are doing. Also, drop a comment in the comments section. If there is a rule that has given a certain moment plot armor in a game that you've really enjoyed, let us know how that game did it, what you enjoyed about it. If there was a game where something completely plot-destroying narrative ending happened in the first 5 minutes and you found yourself sort of deciding to re-rack, or, you know, wondering what was going to happen now that the ring had been dropped down a well in the middle of the Shire, let us know how that played out for you, what you did to solve it, or whether you just sort of moved on from that system and played something else. Look us up on social media. Let us know what your favorite narrative games that aren't narrative games are. But for now, we'll say thank you and goodbye from this episode of Rule of Carnage. So thank you and goodbye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.